Judiciary Committee for Tuesday, May 22nd, 2007. We are going to take the agenda somewhat out of the order in which it's printed. We're going to go first to the bills that have a public hearing and take them in the order in which they're printed, because the first two will take almost no time at all, I'm guessing. Then we'll go back up to take these work sessions, and then at some point at or later than 9:15, we'll go to the hearing on SJR 18. So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 277A. Council Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 277A comes at the request of the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. It replaces the term child with ward in Oregon's Dependency Code 419B when a person under the age of 19 is under the jurisdiction of juvenile court and thus a ward of the court. Amy Miller is here from the Juvenile Rights Project to testify on behalf of the bill.
Okay, Ms. Miller.
Good morning, Chairman Pearson and members of the committee. My name is Amy Miller. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. Just to give a couple of brief comments on Senate Bill 277A, this bill makes a wording change in the juvenile code and the code sections relating to juvenile court guardianship. Basically, all it does is change the wording from child to ward. Really quick, I can tell you the purpose behind the bill is just to clean up the wording in the juvenile code. As I wrote in my testimony, from 2001 to 2003, my organization was part of an Oregon Law Commission work group, which was tasked with resolving issues around the guardianship section of the juvenile code. The legislation from that work group, Senate Bill 70, was passed in 2003. And at the same time, another Oregon Law Commission bill, Senate Bill 69, which was a ward cleanup bill that did the same thing throughout the rest of the juvenile code, was passed. So basically, these two bills missed each other during that session, and the wording was just never changed. A couple of reasons for the change in terminology. First of all, it makes practical sense. In order for the juvenile court guardianship statute to be used, a child must be a ward of the court. That means being under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. So it doesn't make sense for the guardianship statutes to refer to child when, practically speaking, any child to whom they refer is also a ward. This simple word change will make the statutes consistent with the rest of the juvenile code and will eliminate potential confusion for parties and practitioners. Those are my comments. I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have them.
Any questions for Ms. Miller? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. It seems like a simple word change. I wonder if you know why there were a couple of no votes in the Senate.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I do not know. I was actually surprised by that. I do not know the reason there were two no votes in the Senate, but it was a simple word change, and I don't think there was any discussion around the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you're going to be very frustrated if you try to reason why they vote no in that. The rationale is unknown.
Further questions? If not, that's then if not, then I will close the public hearing on 277A and open a work session on Senate Bill 277A.
Mr. Chair, move 277A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 277A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici. Aye. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Excused.
Representative Tom.
Excused.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnick.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
Senate Bill 277A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I would consent calendar on this one,
despite the no votes in the Senate side. Any objection to the consent calendar? Hearing none, then so ordered. Close the work session on Senate Bill 277A. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 279. This bill is a vehicle for some proposals related to financing of the Judicial Department, which are still being worked out in amendment form, so they're rather introducing the bill as its current form Unless people have questions about that process, then what we do is tap it back out and then bring it back to work session when those amendments are ready. Are there any questions or comments on that? Okay, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 279 and announce that we will roll over a work session on Senate Bill 279 till tomorrow in case the amendments are ready for presentation tomorrow. I will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 351A.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 351A comes to you at the request of Senator Brown. It requires the Oregon law enforcement agencies to have written policies regarding missing persons and to have specific procedures for investigating missing persons. I think Mr. Campbell, the proponents had asked Mr. Campbell, Kevin Campbell, to testify first on behalf of the bill.
Mr. Campbell.
Thank you. Chair McPherson and members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Campbell with the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. It's my pleasure today to be before the committee supporting Senate Bill 351A and to ask for adoption of the Dash 5 amendments, which I understand may not be in your possession yet. So that is typical, I think, of this time of session. Legislative Council has a lot to do, and there's a lot in front of them. I want to mention briefly that this bill before you today is result of a number of months of discussions with some folks you'll be hearing from in a few minutes who are advocates for those who are suffering through the process of having to deal with a person in their life who they love who is lost or missing. As you can imagine, this is a tragic series of events, and it's hard for anybody to understand exactly what folks are going through during times like this. This bill, I want to thank Tom and Vicki Kelly from the Tommy Foundation and others who are here today, Crime Victims United and others, who sat down with me at the beginning of the session to craft a bill that we believe will really move forward the partnership between law enforcement and missing persons advocates. It's the critical link, I think, for a missing person process to have law enforcement that's responsive and to have advocates that feel like their needs are being met during a terrible time. The bill before you encourages the adoption of missing persons policies that reflect best practices. And in there it refers to what's called the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. The Oregon Accreditation Alliance is an organization that sets best practices and policies. It's not just an adoption of a policy, though. I mean, we all know that you can adopt a policy and not live by it. So the Oregon Accreditation Alliance for Accredited Agencies ensures through a really, really lengthy process that these agencies not only adopt the process, but that their police officers understand the process or the policy and are operating under the policy. So this bill encourages those missing persons policies to be adopted. It also does something very important that you won't recognize in the language of the bill, but it does authorize the Oregon State Police Crime Lab to utilize a federally funded mitochondrial DNA analysis lab that's located in North Texas currently. The reason we didn't name the lab is on purpose, and that is because, one, they could change the location of the lab, could find a lab closer to Oregon that we might be able to utilize into the future. But what the amendment will do, and I think my testimony will outline it, is that it will allow the Oregon State Police to direct some of these DNA samples to this North Texas lab. The amendment makes clear that the ability to do this is based on the ongoing availability of federal funds. We didn't want to create an obligation for the forensics department that would then end up being unfunded in the future. And so this does authorize the use of labs like that for this kind of DNA analysis. It lists the bill also lists information and material likely to be useful or helpful for identifying missing persons or the human remains of a missing person. And then it allows a person or the executor of an estate to request the destruction of DNA samples if the person is found. Finally, it requires the medical examiner to make reasonable attempts to identify human remains and to consider procedures consistent with the current forensic autopsy performance standards. This is almost like the Oregon Accreditation Alliance, only for the medical examiner community. If you look at my testimony, and now I'm going to conclude because we only have a limited amount of time, there's three sections. I'll outline the provisions of the bill, the provisions of the Dash 5 amendments that you will eventually have in front of you, And the last section is probably the most important. It's a series of commitments because, as you know, everything that's done in this process isn't done necessarily in the language of the bill, but it's done sometimes through commitments that can be made without the need for legislative language. And so if you read through those commitments, you'll find that both the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, along with the Oregon State Forensics Division, are committed to work together with missing person advocates to help ensure that organizations and agencies throughout the state are prepared to partner properly with these important organizations. With that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we have a number of folks here today that want to share their story. And they have committed to be brief because they know that your time is limited. Obviously, they could spend a great amount of time with the committee, and their stories are very important, but they have expressed the willingness to be succinct this morning for your benefit. And I appreciate the committee's time to hear their stories and to spend some time with them this morning. So with that, Chair McPherson and members of the committee, that concludes my testimony. I would be glad to answer any questions, and hopefully we'll have the Dash 5 amendments soon.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Do you have I realize it's in the hands of others, but do you have any guess as to when those amendments might be available?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, we have just called Senator Brown's office, and we are in the process of tracking the amendments down.
And so we think they will be available this morning?
We hope so. The person has them is in a meeting, and we've asked to get the person out of the meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And hopefully the amendments, I believe the amendments will reflect the consensus request that all of the groups together sent down to Legislative Council. I believe that it will.
Mr. Campbell, do you have a suggestion as to particularly about order or how we bring people up in panels here from this list, or should we just guys just start calling from the names that are here on the list?
That would be fine, Chair McPherson. I think if you could, you might want to call Vicki Kelly to present first, and then any of the rest in whatever order you prefer.
Okay, Ms. Kelly then.
Good day, Chairperson McPherson and members of the Oregon House Judiciary Committee. I am Vicki Kelly, Executive Director of the Tommy Foundation, a missing child safety nonprofit organization in Jackson County, Oregon. And I am a volunteer with Project Jason's Campaign for the Missing, a coalition of parents, family members, and loved ones who across the country are advocating in their own states similar missing persons legislation to Oregon Senate Bill 351 that we are here today to support. To honor the lives of Oregon Miranda Gaddis, Ashley Pond, and Domingo Ramirez, we have dubbed Senate Bill 351 the Gaddis-Pond Ramirez Act. You will be hearing from a couple of those mothers today. We wish to express our heartfelt appreciation and gratitude to Senator Kate Brown, her legislative assistant Mara Gross, Kelly Jokowski, and Robert Bristow with Project Jason's Campaign for the Missing, George Adams with the Center for Human Identification, Steve Dole from Crime Victims United, Mary Ellich, President of the Oregon Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children, and Oregon law enforcement, especially Kevin Campbell, who all have worked with us on Senate Bill 351. I am also the mother of 17-year-old Tommy Kelly, who was reported missing in 1999 and who remained missing for a year and a half. In 2000, we recovered Tommy's skull and 25 bones located in 25-foot by 30-foot, a mile length of blackberry bushes. Because DNA was too expensive and not done in my son's case, we still have never conclusively been sure the remains my husband and I buried were those of our son. When our son was identified, we made a vow at that time to be a voice for the missing. Each year, families in Oregon struggle with the agony of having to report a missing loved one. Often, missing person investigations grow cold, leaving many to cope with this loss. Far too often, the families and loved ones of the missing are left without answers, sometimes for years, and unfortunately, sometimes forever. In my work at the Tommy Foundation, and a senior coordinator with Team Hope at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I have extended support to over 2,200 searching families, many from here in Oregon. I too often have seen that not all law enforcement agencies are knowledgeable or have a policy in responding and investigation of missing persons cases. Senate Bill 351 will improve the collection of critical information about missing persons, prioritize high-risk missing persons cases, and assure prompt dissemination of critical information to other law enforcement agencies and the public that can improve the likelihood of a safe return. Nationwide, the number of unidentified remains projected by the International Association for Homicide Investigators is somewhere between 40,000 to 50,000. This number is only a conservative approximation and does not consider the number of unidentified that have been cremated and buried in a pauper's grave. According to Dr. Arthur Eisenberg, renowned DNA expert and director of the Center for Human Identification, the number of families with long-term missing loved ones over the past 20 years can only be estimated in the hundreds of thousands. This legislation establishes procedures for collecting information during the missing persons reporting process that can later be used to help identify human remains. We are, after all, not talking about numbers, but about human beings. This legislation will enhance law enforcement's ability to increase the number who do come back home. Hope is often the only thing that families and loved ones of the missing have. We hope you will join us in support of Oregon's Senate Bill 351, the Gaddis Pond Ramirez Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly.
Do you have any questions?
Appears not. And we'll have Yvonne Company next. And while she's coming forward, I have a separate entry here, Parents of Murdered Children Multnomah. Is there an individual with that organization? Very good. Why don't you come forward as well, and then you can present after Ms. Company is finished.
Good morning, Chair Representative McPherson and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to present my testimony for Bill 351, which is known as the Gaddis Pond Ramirez Act. My name is Yvonne Company. I am the mother of Domingo Company Ramirez. I live in Selma, Oregon, Josephine County. I'm here today to ask you to vote yes on this bill and will try to share with you what happens when your child does not come home. Domingo was 21 when he and his dog Candy went to camp in the Siskiyou National Forest. He's been missing since June 5th of 2004. His son was born 4 months after he disappeared. The hospital would not put his name on the birth certificate because he was not present. We're still fighting that issue. I believe if the Gaddis Pond Ramirez Act was in place, my call to report Domingo missing would have been taken seriously. The sheriff's office refused to call out search and rescue, even though we knew exactly where Domingo went to go camping. As his mother, I knew something was horribly wrong. I called the sheriff's office a day later to tell them that they had the wrong color of the car. They told me to stop bothering them. The color did not matter. Family and friends started driving the mountains looking for my son. We called all the surrounding counties, law enforcement and National Forest offices in Southern Oregon and Northern California. My father called 5 days later, which was a Thursday, and asked if there was a multi-state APB for the missing car in Domingo. My father was told to call back on Monday, which would have been 9 days from the day he went missing, to speak to the officer who took the report. My father begged, asked if it cost any money to do it now. The officer replied no and reluctantly said he would do it before the end of his shift. My father asked the officer if he'd call him back when he issued the APB, and he said no, he would not do that. A personal friend who had search and rescue experience mounted a search party. 8 days after Domingo disappeared, his dog Candy was found by one of our friends. She had 2 gunshot wounds and is alive today. This is when we called 911 and the sheriff finally called out search and rescue. A day and a half later, another family friend found personal items hidden near where Candy was found. The car that Domingo was driving was found in Klamath Falls, 140 miles away, 6 weeks later. My son is still missing. I've used the internet to search out information about other families of missing children and how they searched. One of the most difficult tasks was to identify remains. I have called hospitals, morgues, funeral homes, looking for John Doe's, hoping that Domingo is one of the unidentified missing. Every single place handled John Doe's differently. It took many months before I registered Domingo with the National Center for Missing Adults. Vicki Kelly with the Tell Me Foundation convinced me that I needed to register Domingo and help me get started. I believe that every day I looked for him, I would find him. It wasn't necessary to register him. Bill 351 will change how missing person report will be handled. That report will have to be accepted when they are made, and law enforcement couldn't refuse to accept a report for any reason. The information shall be entered in the state federal records within 12 hours. The state police will have a clearinghouse of information on missing people. The bill creates a list for information to be collected: name, date of birth, blood type, driver's license, social security numbers, and many other identifying pieces of information. Notification of high-risk cases will be reported to the state police immediately, and the news will be spread around Oregon and nearby states. I could not get my son's case out of our county, no matter what I did, how many times it was on TV, news, newspaper. It will shorten the time the medical examiner who can't identify human remains before notifying the state police from the current 30 days to 24 hours after the remains are brought to the examiner's attention. If the examiner does identify the remains, the police will be immediately notified. In my son's case, we have no fingerprints, only the baby teeth for his DNA. I have no x-rays for dental records. He had perfect teeth. This bill will allow the agency to collect DNA after a missing person is not found within 30 days. The family can agree to submit these samples along with fingerprints and additional photos. You have no idea how alone you feel trying to everything in your power to find your child. This is an emotional place that you will never know until this happens to you. There's nothing you can do to prepare for anything like this. Every day when I wake, fall asleep in my dreams, I try to figure out where my son Domingo is. The Gaddis Pond Ramirez Act will give every law enforcement agency a guideline on how to handle a missing persons report and unidentified remains. It will allow the agency to act on the case immediately and to start an investigation. I believe that by identifying a missing person, law enforcement can bring justice to those who are responsible for taking our children from us. Those people who have committed these crimes are walking amongst us. They need to be held responsible for taking our children. This bill will affect those who have gone missing before Domingo and those who will go missing in the future. There are many other states that are passing bills such as this one. No one should have to endure what I have gone through. The first 24 to 48 hours are the most crucial in locating a missing person. The Senate sent a unanimous yes vote for Bill 351, and I'm asking you to send the same message to the people of the state of Oregon. Thank you. And any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Company. And this comment applies to your situation, really, all the other stories we're hearing that we understand the tragedies that have happened in your families, and we're quite sympathetic to that, and we appreciate your coming forward because it helps inform our decision-making here in the Capitol.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative McPherson, for allowing me to speak and for the other representatives for being here. My name is Mary Elledge, and I'm testifying and presenting information before you today on behalf of the Greater Portland Chapter of Parents of Murdered Children. Nearly 21 years ago, my son was brutally murdered by three men in our home. His body was thrown in the back of a pickup and buried in a shallow grave for over 5 weeks. Each day seemed like an eternity. He had never gone away without letting us know. We would never have found his body at that time if one of the men had not bragged about murdering our son. One of his family members called the police. The detectives were able to go to get two of the men to confess where they had buried the body. His body was so decomposed, though, we could never see it. I could never touch his hair or kiss him goodbye. Losing a child in a violent manner is a parent's worst nightmare. Never knowing what happened to your loved one is like a trip to hell. What you imagine can be even worse than what happened to them. It plays over and over in your mind. Today, I am pleading with you to listen to our stories. For nearly 21 years, I have heard hundreds of stories of family members who have never been able to recover the body of their loved ones. Some of the lucky ones were found body parts that could be identified. There are thousands of body parts that have never been identified in the United States. Not knowing makes every day more painful. It is bad enough that we never got to say goodbye. But now, because of Vicki Kelly, a mother who looked for the remains of her son for a year and a half, we are closer to helping families in Oregon find their missing loved ones. She has joined with others in the passing of model legislation that will ensure that information that could help with identifying human remains is properly collected and reported. We need passage of the missing person legislation. It is so important, and every family whose loved one is missing deserves all the support and help we can give them. It also will assist in solving murder cases. Every day is like an eternity for a family whose loved one is missing. Please support SB 351. And I would be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Isn't this Ellich? Is that
Ellich, yes. Mary Ellich.
Yes. Thank you very much for coming forward. Any questions, Ms. Ellich? Thank you very much.
Thank you for allowing me to speak.
We'll now have a panel that combines Dolores Cook, Michelle Duffy, and Dee Dee Coons.
Good morning, Representative McPherson and members of the committee and Bill. I've been an advocate for crime victims for many years. My husband and I started Crime Victims United after gathering together some 12, I think, other parents of murdered children, and have on and off haunted the halls, as been said of us, here at the legislature. Our daughter, Valerie.
I'm going to break in, but identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Dee Dee Coons, and I live in Wilsonville. My daughter was murdered in 1980, and she was a graduate of San Francisco's Art Institute, and there was every reason to immediately know that she had befallen to bad circumstances, and we did know in our hearts that she had been murdered very quickly. We went down to San Francisco, and because we were very dissatisfied with nothing happening at all, we hired some investigators and for a short period of time, and then became somewhat accomplished investigators ourselves. So we did find out pretty much what happened. The first month that Val was missing, the men who were responsible for her murder and disposing of her body cranked up their criminal world, and all kinds of stories came out, which is not at all unusual with a missing person, I found. They said that she was buried in a well. They said her body was put in new concrete in a building in San Francisco. They said her body was placed in the trunk of a car that was crushed and sent to Japan as scrap metal. Every ugly thing that they could think of came to us one way or another. And I thought that I would die if I did not know what happened to her. And all of these years since have been fired by that pain and outrage and anger and sympathy for other people, hoping that other people wouldn't have to go through what I did. My daughter's body was finally found 11 years after she was missing in a river up by the Canadian border. She had been taken in the trunk of a car with her feet in concrete. Her feet and legs are still in that river. It took another 9 years before she was identified, and that was a pure chance. A nice and caring forensics examiner in Sacramento, California, had remembered seeing some unusual incisor teeth, and we had given x-rays of Val's teeth, and they had a hook on them. And when they sent out about every other year information on her remains, he had remembered. And so 9 years after her body was found and 20 years to the exact day of when her body was placed in the river, she was identified. And finally, we were able to bury her remains the same year that my husband died, and she lies beside his ashes. I know that you hear a lot of sad stories, but this is one that, as the lady before me said, you can't really know unless you experience. But I'd like you to try to imagine one of your children or your spouse or someone missing, and you didn't have any ability to be able to find them or get the help that you needed to find them. I beg you to try as you might clear up some of this problem. There are over 100,000 remains or part of remains that have not been identified in the United States, and that's an outrage. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Coons, for sharing your story. Let's hear from the other members of the panel. Ms. Cook?
My name is Dolores Cook, and I'm here to represent Senate Bill 351. My granddaughter was 17 when she come up missing, and due to the fact that she was 17, we couldn't get anybody to help us, the police department, nobody, because she was considered a runaway. And even though we knew she wasn't a runaway, so I had to take it, my family and I took it upon ourselves to do the searches. And we had a business, which made it a little bit easier for us, but we took our retirement of $42,000 that we had and got volunteers. We shut our business down with employees of 65, and we got dog searches. I mean, we did this for 9 solid months and hired a private investigator to find my granddaughter. And if it hadn't been for what I did with the phone lines and everything, they would have never won the case in court a year later when they found her. And I guess I'm speaking out for the fact that we was able to come up with this money. We couldn't even get a picture on the TV of her because she was nobody to them. And but my heart goes out to the people that can't find their loved ones, that don't have the means and the money to do this like we did. And I would highly wish that you would consider the Senate Bill 351.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. Michelle Duffy.
Good morning, Mr. or Representative McPherson and members of the House. I'm Michelle Duffy. I now live in Kaiser, Oregon. Miranda Gaddis was my daughter. She's was 13 in 2002 when she disappeared. And luckily, unfortunately, under the circumstances, she had a friend from the same place had disappeared 2 months before. So somehow it ended up to be national news. I was very lucky to get national news because we had the FBI on it that night. We had the FBI and not only Oregon City Police, but we had police from all over Oregon helping, volunteering, and for about eight and a half months, they did make a task force. Unfortunately, they didn't have a place to put it. It was a big long table in the middle of the Oregon City Fire Station, and they did the best they could. And I was one of the very lucky ones to get a lot of help. I was on the news a lot. Miranda and Ashley Pond, I kept their faces out there as much as I could. Unfortunately, you don't see that very often. Every time you see one person on the TV, there's probably 10 more that disappear at the same time. Excuse me. You just don't hear about it. You have to know the right people. You have to, I don't know how, mine just happened to be. And most people don't have that. You see someone's picture on TV for a day or two, and other people on that see it, they move on, get on with their lives, and we're stuck. And they found my daughter that same year, and Ashley, and we're still living it. We still have a hard time, and I don't know if it's because of the pressure, because it was national when they found them, but within a day we knew the remains, who they were. And this bill hopefully can help others, and we try to help when people go missing. We talk to each other, all of us that have been through it, to try to help others, but we really need this bill to pass so we can have everyone have the same everyone can have the same chance that I did, that I was lucky enough to have it constantly out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Steffi. Any questions for any member of this panel? Well, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your story. I know that for any parent, I think the greatest fear that we have is that our children, regardless of age, don't come back to us. So I appreciate your telling us about your experience.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Campbell, we have the Dash 5 amendments, and I wonder if it would be before us now. Would it be helpful for you to walk us through those and maybe how that those amendments fit into the bill?
Thank you, Chair McPherson. In addition to the testimony I submitted earlier, there's just an adjustment in the amendment that is minor that I want to point out to you, and that is that in the testimony, one of the considerations is that there is, through this bill, a recommendation that we change the Missing Children's Clearinghouse name. And in my testimony, I referred to that new name as the Missing Children's and Persons Clearinghouse. In the amendment, it's Missing Children's and Adults. There's a reason for that, because children are persons. So that would have been it wouldn't have made much sense for that to say Missing Children's and Persons Clearinghouse. This is something that Judy Hayes with the Oregon State Police, who operates the Missing Children's Clearinghouse, is supportive of. They believe they can handle this responsibility currently without additional resources, but it does require the name change to recognize the fact that all of these missing persons are important. And so that's important. That's the last part of the amendment. The other amendments also that may be a little confusing, on line 10 of the Dash 5 amendment, this is the one that allows the Oregon State Police, rather than in the original bill, Oregon State Police would have to receive all DNA samples and then forward them to the North Texas lab. This amendment clarifies that Oregon State Police can direct the sample directly to the lab from the law enforcement agency. And so that's a little clarification of line 10. The other thing that I think is particularly important to the advocates here today is in line 4, which says that if a person who's been reported as missing has not been located within 30 days, that there'd be attempts made to get additional DNA that can be sent in for analysis. That's very important. And I would like to add that one of the keys for this measure is that law enforcement is often responsive, but occasionally is not, or they mishandle one of these cases. Our goal is to decrease the chance that this happens in the future, and a lot of that has to do with a partnership, I think, that has to exist between groups like the Tommy Foundation and others and our law enforcement agencies, and that's through this discussion has really been the fruit of the discussion, I believe. So with that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we ask you for your support for Senate Bill 351A and for adoption of the Dash 5 amendments.
Mr. Campbell, I was just quizzing counsel here about whether we had any fiscal information on this. I was wondering if you had any information. The bill requires DNA samples to be provided to law enforcement, and that those are retained for a certain amount of time, apparently, while the person is missing. I was just wondering if there's any analysis that had been done on that.
Yes, Chair McPherson and members of the committee, I don't believe there's a fiscal impact to the bill. I worked closely with Vicki Kelly, but also with the Forensics Department of State Police, the medical examiner, and there was no fiscal impact that based on our discussions with them with the amendments.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair. Kevin, do you know how much time the detectives are getting at BST on this type of training? It seems like we seem to have more of this going on. I can remember when I went in the state police, there was no training in 64 on that subject. And it would be interesting to know if you knew anything, because if not, I would like to explore. I mean, they get their 16 weeks, but when they do their follow-up and they go into the detective divisions, it would be appropriate, I think, for those people to have some enhanced training and recognition of how important this is to people.
Yeah, Chair Krieger and members of the committee, or Chair McPherson and Representative Krieger, they do have training. It is not included in the 16 weeks from the detective side, but I know that the forensics division does training. Frankly, part of this is advances in technology require additional training. I don't know the specific amount, and I would be glad to investigate for you and get back to you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions, Mr. Campbell? Councilor Taylor.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Campbell, I'm looking at the Dash 5 Amendment, Section 4, and I assume that's a new responsibility. If a person who has been reported as missing has not been located within 30 days after the missing person report is made, the law enforcement agency that accepted the missing report shall attempt to obtain a DNA sample from the missing person or from the family members of the missing person.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
You know, it was that element that would cause me to ask about what the obligations would be here, whether law enforcement would have extra obligations as a result of.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, the number of missing persons that go beyond the 30 days is a smaller number, and I don't believe that because these are agencies throughout the state, any one agency is not dealing with a lot of these. And from law enforcement's perspective, this seems like a very reasonable responsibility on our part and does not represent a significant fiscal impact from our standpoint.
Okay.
Briefly, Mr. Chair, I think this is a good bill to try to standardize some things for the police. As Mr. Campbell just said, most of the time those are handled well, but not always. And I'm thinking back to some cases where somebody who really shouldn't have been in that position was in that position and just sloughed everything off. And this will, I think, help the families. It is easy to think that a teenage, a 17-year-old missing 17-year-old is a runaway, because so many times that's how it ends up. But in the cases where that's not the case, an immediate response would be, or a fast response would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. Very good. If there are no further questions for Mr. Campbell, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 351 and open a work session on Senate Bill 351.
We need a motion for the Dash 5.
We do need a motion on the Dash 5.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the Dash 5 amendments to the A engrossed version of House Senate Bill 351.
Representative Cameron moves the Dash A5 amendments into the A engrossed version of Senate Bill 351. Is there any discussion of the motion? Any objection? Then the Dash A5 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 351A engrossed as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves the Senate Bill 351 as amended by the Dash A5 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Excused.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Excused.
Representative Koff?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Excused.
Chairman
Person? Aye. Senate Bill 351A as amended moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Good.
And we have a volunteer for carrying the bill. Representative Cameron? Thank you very much. Okay, I close the work session on Senate Bill 351. Going back up to the top of the agenda here now. Let's stand at ease until she comes to council. On Senate Bill 296A. Council Stanford, remind us what's happening on this bill.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, and members of the committee. Give me a second to find my summary here. Senate Bill 296A relates to the classification of illegal drugs, specifically marijuana, on the Oregon Sentencing Guidelines grid. Present ORS 475.900 classifies drug crimes according to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission Sentencing Guideline grid. Presently, Level 8 drug offenses, those are the most serious drug offenses, include delivery and manufacture of drugs in substantial quantities, delivery, manufacture, possession of drugs as what's known as a commercial drug offense, which there are various factors that go into that consideration. Delivery of manufacture of drugs within 1,000 feet of a school, certain methamphetamine manufacture offenses, and then just simple delivery of marijuana. Those are the classification of drugs at the level 8 offense level. The last offense, delivery of marijuana, was erroneously included as a level 8 offense last session. It was simply a numbering error from, I believe, just from legislative counsel in the, as part of the meth package last year when drugs were reclassified. Delivery of marijuana was erroneously included as a level 8 offense last session. Just for example, delivery of cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, those are level 6 offenses. And elsewhere, another statute clarifies delivery of marijuana is supposed to be a level 4 offense. So Senate Bill 296A addresses this error. It removes the reference to delivery of marijuana as being a level 8 offense. However, it does clarify that delivery of marijuana can be a level 8 offense if it's to a person under 18 and the accused is over 18 and at least 3 years older than the underage person. It also clarifies that delivery of any controlled substance other than marijuana that's in Schedules 1, 2, or 3 to a person under 18 is a Level 8 offense.
And we're in work session rather than public hearing. I think we just tapped it in and out before, Council.
Right.
So, but was there anybody here? Is there anybody here who wanted to present on Senate Bill 296? Well, if not, then here we are in work session.
I'll move House Bill 296A Gross to the floor to do pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill Senate Bill 296A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
I had a question mark on this one. I read it about whether there was a fiscal.
There should not be.
Okay.
I haven't seen, but no, there's. I can't imagine that there'd be a fiscal on this. If anything, it's reducing it because I could no longer charge somebody with a level 8 offense for delivery of marijuana. Level 8 is a presumptive prison sentence. Level 4 is not. It's presumptive probation.
Mr. Chair, was that I believe that was the only error that the Meth Task Force group made last year, wasn't it?
Well, I think it was a pretty good piece of work, if that's all we messed up with. I think there was that isotomic something or other.
Yeah. Who understands that anyway? Yeah.
I couldn't even say it already. Isomers? I remember I carried
it. Isomers, right? Yeah. So we have a motion before us to move Senate Bill 296A to the floor. We do pass. Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici. Aye. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Morris.
Excused.
Representative Koch.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Buckley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisman.
Excused.
Chairman Person.
Aye. Senate Bill 296A moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and it really is just fixing an error, but do you think that it would be red flags?
I'd be glad to carry this
brief.
It
would be helpful just to reassure people, I think.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Thank you, Representative Barker. I will then close the work session on Senate Bill 296A. And
we do not yet have the amendments, so we can roll this over. Any questions?
Okay. So on Senate Bill 347A, I understand we're waiting for amendments, Ms. Christian, and I know those will not be with us today, I assume. So we will roll that over till tomorrow's meeting. So this is notice that we'll be taking up the work session on Senate Bill 347A tomorrow. And I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 464A. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 464A, again, was before us yesterday. It relates to the creation of the Class B felony of aggravated identity theft. Present ORS 165.800 creates the crime, the Class C felony of identity theft. The elements include a person has the intent to deceive or defraud, that person obtains, possesses, converts to the person's own use the personal identification of someone else. Personal identification includes a broad array of written documents or electronic data. What Senate Bill 464A does is it expands the offense of Class C felony identity theft by creating a new aggravated identity theft, which would be a Class B felony. The elements of aggravated identity theft include basically committing the Class C felony, but doing it 10 or more times within a 180-day period, or committing identity theft and the amount of damage is over $10,000 in a 180-day period, or committing identity theft where the defendant has 10 or more pieces of identification from 10 or more different persons. In those situations, the person would be could be accused and charged with aggravated identity theft. And there was discussion yesterday. I'd raised the point about Mr. Prinz with Oregon Criminal Justice Commission having some concerns about whether this would actually have a lesser impact, lesser sentence versus present repo law. Repeat property offender law for these types of persons, and my understanding is that those concerns have been worked out among the parties, and it's sort of an alternate charging mechanism that prosecutors could go with.
Okay. I'm looking to see what fiscal information we have on this.
Let's see. Minimal.
Okay, very good. Well, we're in work session committee. The one concern that had been expressed about this bill was has been resolved with information received from the Criminal Justice Commission, so that that concern is resolved.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 464A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 464A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Just briefly, I'm going to support this, but the $10,000 I think is way too high on that. I think we're out of line, but I mean, I think that should be reduced because these crimes are just so prolific. But that being said, I'll vote for it.
Very good.
They carry this one forward. Mark.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bumblebee.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Excused.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative
Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Excused.
Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Senate Bill 464A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the Chair will carry the bill. Close the public hearing, the work session, rather, on Senate Bill 464. Open a work session on Senate Bill 1017. Council Stanford.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, again, this bill we talked about and heard testimony on yesterday. I'll go ahead and re-summarize what the bill does, and then we have amendments, the dash A5 amendments that were completed late last night and that were in response to concerns that committee members had. Again, Senate Bill 1017A relates to the reporting of the crime of aggravated animal abuse and then the link between animal abuse and child abuse. Studies suggesting that persons who abuse animals are highly likely to also abuse children or their domestic partners. ORS 167.322 details the Class C felony of aggravated animal abuse. The offense involves the malicious killing or intentional torture of an animal. Under Oregon law, a veterinarian is required to report suspected aggravated animal abuse to a law enforcement agency anytime the vet has come into contact with the animal or come into contact with a person suspected of committing the abuse. The law provides civil and criminal immunity for any vet who makes such a report in good faith. Senate Bill 1017A expands the class of persons who may report such abuse without fear of lawsuits or prosecution from merely vets to include also any public or private official. However, there is one very significant distinction. Vet reporting of aggravated animal abuse is mandatory, but public or private officials reporting is discretionary. If the official chooses to report, the official does not face litigation. Nothing happens to the official for declining to report. The term public or private official in Senate Bill 1017A mirrors the definition in existing Oregon Law 419B005 sub 3, which is the child abuse reporting statute. It includes physicians, dentists, social workers, attorneys, firefighters, members of the legislature. This class of persons already has the mandatory child abuse reporting obligation under Oregon law. An official's failure to report child abuse is a Class A violation. But here, there is no penalty for officials who choose not to report aggravated animal abuse. The reporting is merely permissive. And then yesterday, Mr. Sparks from Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and others testified about the bill and the link between it, domestic violence, et cetera. There were concerns that were addressed, and the dash A5 amendments are in. And there are two things. One, I believe Representative Wisnett had asked about spelling out what the purpose of this bill was within, like, perhaps a legislative finding, and that's what you see in Section 1. Legislative Assembly finds there's a clear link between animal cruelty and crimes of domestic violence, including child abuse, and it is in the public interest to enact legislation to encourage the permissive reporting of animal cruelty. So that was in response to Representative Wisnett's concern. And then the other primary concern had to do with a class of persons under the definition of law enforcement that you could report to, and it was on Section 1, lines 14 and 15. Law enforcement division of a humane society in Oregon that employs special agents. And we heard testimony, I believe, from the Farm Bureau and others expressing some concern about that. The dash A5 amendment eliminates that those persons.
So, committee, as you just heard from council, the purpose of the A5 amendments was to respond to the concerns that were expressed yesterday, particularly that on the second issue, there is a separate bill that will engage this issue of humane special agents, and that's a separate debate, but the preference of the
Senate Judiciary Committee chair who brought, it was that committee that brought this bill forward, was to get just get that concept out of this bill, so we're not making any statement one way or the other about the merits of that issue. So we have purely the issue of reporting of animal abuse and its connection to child abuse presented by this bill. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that there's a concern about that law enforcement division of Humane Society, and to keep this bill moving, I'll agree to that. The only thing that concerns me is that there may be some people who fall within this category, like a school employee or dentist or something, whose first inclination when they see animal abuse is to call the Humane Society. And so I just want to make sure that we're not losing some of those important calls that I mean, it's the intent of the bill to get that animal abuse reported. And so if they're inclined to, they might not think call law enforcement, they might think call Humane Society. So hopefully there's some mechanism within the Humane Society where they, if they get the call and there's aggravated animal abuse, that they'll in turn then report it to law enforcement. I just want to make sure that we're not having instances that are serious fall through the cracks because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, useful thing to get on the record. Any further discussion on Senate Bill 1017?
Chair McPherson, I apologize to you and the committee because I missed part of this discussion yesterday, but my only concern, it's a little different than Representative Bonamici's when this first came to us yesterday. As a reporter of many child abuse cases as a school administrator, my first question wasn't about, well, how are you treating your dog? I just want to, I don't know if there's anything in the bill that states, if you're thinking there is a correlation between animal abuse and child abuse, that you're not just making one phone call, you're making two. You're making one to the Department of Human Services to report your suspected child abuse that's correlated with this. And I don't see that, but, and I will support the bill because I understand that there is a real clear amount of research about if somebody's abusing an animal, that behavior happens other places. But I don't want just one phone call made.
And would underscore the fact that this bill doesn't, there's mandatory reporting of child abuse, and this is authorized, yes. Permitted reporting, but not
right.
Required reporting
right.
Of aggravated animal abuse. Any further discussion? And do I hear a motion on the Dash A5 amendments? Representative Kump.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A5s into Senate Bill 1017.
Representative Kump moves the Dash A5 amendments into Senate Bill 1017A. Any discussion of that motion?
Just to say that without the amendments, I couldn't possibly be with the bill. And there are some other issues that we're going to deal with in a couple other bills that I think we need to have plenty of time when we do it. Mm-hmm. But this is there is a connection. You all know where I am on the dependency issue and children, foster care. I think we've all demonstrated that, how we, you know, and adult abuse, spousal abuse. All this is connected.
Mm-hmm. Any further discussion of the motion? Any objection to the adoption of the Dash A5 amendments? Then the Dash A5 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Kump.
I move Senate Bill 1017A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kump moves Senate Bill 1017A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Forrest.
Excused.
Representative
Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lisnett?
Excused.
Chairman Person?
Aye. Senate Bill 1017A has amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Kopp, would you carry that?
I'll be happy to.
Terrific. We have one bill remaining on.
Can I bring my dog? Trust me, you don't.
On the floor.
You don't want to. He's too hyper.
We have one piece of legislation remaining on our agenda, which is SJR 18A, which cannot be heard before 9:15, which we are nearly to. That we need Senator Przanski here to do so. So we're going to stand at ease until we can locate Senator Przanski to join us. Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Tuesday, May 22nd, with one remaining measure on our agenda, which is SJR 18A. Council Taylor, give us a little introduction.
Chair, members of the committee, SJR 18A comes to you from Senator Przanski, who's sitting before you. It amends Section 10, Article 15 of the Constitution of the State of Oregon as it relates to the Oregon Property Act of 2000. It allows forfeitures without conviction if the forfeiting agencies prove the property constitutes proceeds or instrumentality of a crime, allows state and local law enforcement to obtain shared proceeds from the United States Department of Justice resulting from state and local government enforcement's participation in federal forfeiture, allows forfeitures without criminal conviction when the property is abused and neglected animal. Chair, members of the committee, you may remember back in 2000 the voters approved ballot measure 3. Requiring basically that you have a criminal conviction before you have a forfeiture in most circumstances. That ballot measure was recently upheld in 2006 in the case of linking interagency narcotic team versus Kitzhoffer.
Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. SJR 18 is really a product of what happened last session. Representative Olson and myself were engaged in trying to massage the ballot measure that was passed by the voters in 2000 to answer some needs and concerns that had been raised in different venues, including with law enforcement and their ability to work within the framework. There was a discussion that we had at that time, and we asked two individuals, Dave Fedenke from ACLU, Rob Olivet, who represents numerous groups, but he is the county council for Lincoln County, also serves as the legal advisor for the Oregon Narcotics Officers Association. They actually were the ones that pushed the pencils and got the everything together for us at our request. They continue to work up until almost the close of session for us to actually come forward and put together a measure that was adopted by the legislature last session. Part of the agreement that was reached between the four of us was that there was a challenge that was ongoing for ballot measure 3 as to whether or not it was constitutional. And as your counsel said today, the courts did in fact find it to be constitutional, that there was the nexuses that were necessary to tie some of the subject matter that was within the measure to each other, and that it stands today as law. The understanding that was reached last session was that if it was in fact held to be constitutional, that the parties would come before this legislature and ask for the legislature to refer to the voters an amended ballot measure 3 that would give a little bit more flexibility than what ballot measure 3 provided. Specifically, that some of the funds, once there has been a conviction of an individual, could in fact be used by law enforcement. And so that's really the key, because measure 3 basically preempted the use of revenue that was taken in through forfeiture sales to go back to use within the law enforcement arena, with a few exceptions to that. So that's kind of snapshot nutshell as to why we're here today with SJR 18 to follow through with the agreements that were reached last session based on the bill that went forward. I do want to point out, I understand that there's now before you a A4 set of amendments, and it's been directed to me that this would actually address the issue on page 3, lines 13 and 14 of the bill in the A and Gross, which would basically allow for the forfeiture of animals without going through and needing to get the conviction of the individual before the forfeiture could take place. The reason that has come before us is that there's a particular case that came to light, and this is not uncommon, but that one, it shows a little bit more on the extreme side. It's what I have referred to as the Great Bunny Caper. The Great Bunny Caper was an individual who had taken in and was housing a number of rabbits, apparently over or close to 200 rabbits. They were neglected. And that information came to law enforcement. Law enforcement, with the Humane Society, I believe, their officers went in and found a situation that was, let's say, not worthy of those animals being kept in house in such a way. So they took possession of all of the animals that were still alive. They found dead ones in different parts of the on the premises. I believe that the majority of those were being stored like in a deep freeze. What happened next is, because of all those animals that needed to be maintained and kept and cared for until you go through the process of getting the forfeiture action completed and the individual being actually convicted, the individual who was charged with the offense, she chose to break in to the facility where the animals were being stored. They had been segregated out from male from female, and she basically just stuck them all in the back of a vehicle and took off for the state line and actually made it into Washington State. There was somehow information got back to our law enforcement. They were able to catch up with her and the rabbits, and they had to bring the rabbits back and then put them under 24-hour armed guard. So that is why different entities, including district attorney who used to be with the Department of Justice, who's now in Crook County, came forward and asked if that amendment could be put in place. And that's why you have it there. What is on the record in the House, on the Senate floor, when I carried SJR 18, is the understanding that there is a process that has to be done before a forfeiture can occur of an animal. That process is that you have to go to court. You have to get a magistrate. You have to get a judge to actually rule that the forfeiture process should go forward without the conviction. So there are the safeguards in place already through the judicial process to ensure that any individual who may find themselves having their animals taken for neglect, abuse, or abandonment would still have the ability to go before a judge before there would be an outright forfeiture of those animals, and then they could be disposed of in whatever means they were contemplated by the agency that had jurisdiction over them. So with that, I'll try to answer any questions you may have, Mr. Chair or committee members.
Gibson is clear.
Senator, how many more rabbits did she have at the end of the trip compared to the beginning of the trip?
Well, I always go back to the Bill Cosby album, right? Only two rabbits, and when they were loading them into Noah's Ark, and I think they ended up with more than just two.
One other question.
Go ahead.
There has been, Senator, some concern about that from Farm Bureau. Got a letter here from Senator Winsent. And it seems like the wording is kind of awkward to understand what it means because I read it, and I went and talked to Representative Barker last night. I tried to see staff. He wasn't here early this morning.
He was actually.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was with Senator Wizard at 7 o'clock this morning.
Excuse me.
And 5:30 last night.
But anyway,
asked to see
it almost sounds, you know, my concern was, is that the part that says you, back on the first page, that you had to have a conviction, didn't apply to this.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's okay. And that's correct. It does not, in the sense of if the way this would play out, Mr. Chair, excuse me, Representative Krieger, if you had a situation where, let's use the rabbits, since that's the ones that's on the table, the agency could go before a court and say, here's the situation we have. We're asking the court to allow us to move forward and placing these animals or doing whatever may be necessary. The court would need to make a determination that they're going to be successful or more likely to be successful in the underlying proceeding before they would actually allow that to occur. Or the court could put some type of limitations as to allowing them to be, let's say, fostered, but not actually changing ownership at that point in time. What happens on any of these referrals to the voters or just as a citizen initiative when it passes at the poll, the following legislative session, there is always going to be a need to have language that is drafted to implement whatever has been passed by the voters. And that is where we could actually put into law some of these other concerns. Now, clearly, if you're concerned enough to the point that you want something into the SJR, you could, in fact, put in something, an amendment with the subsection 10 on page 3, line 13, that would basically set out that the legislature shall adopt rules as to how this would be played out through a judicial proceeding. Something like that to make certain it's there. As I said, it's already on the record, and it would be my intention that if the voters did approve this, I mean, it's not a done deal. I mean, the voters could, in fact, say they like Measure 3, and we're going to leave Measure 3. We're not going to modify it. But then they could say we want to do this, and if so, we could actually have it in the resolution, or we could just know that we'll be dealing with that upon passage.
Chair, yesterday, Farm Bureau came in and I think cattlemen, and they were concerned that they hadn't caught this over there, this part of the bill. And then they got over here, they saw it, and they had concerns. Have you talked to them at all about what your interpretation of that meaning of those words are?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I have not personally spoken to them since this came to our attention. It actually came to our attention before the bill moved across the Senate floor. We put on the record as to those issues that were of concern. One of the issues that did come up at the last moment that I think has now risen to a higher level is in the area of on the North Coast, Tillamook area, where you have a lot of cattle dairy farms and where you may have flooding, and the concern that someone comes by and sees these animals out in the field and standing in water, that they may be reported and taken into consideration. I mean, I would tell you, and I think Representative, you would know as well as from your background, to think that law enforcement and or a district attorney is going to go in and start a proceeding based on a natural catastrophe and try to hold the owner liable as to abandonment, neglect, or abuse in those type of situations is pretty far flung that you would see that. But again, I think that there's easy ways to fix this, and I would again suggest either if it give more comfort for the House side. I know it definitely would not hurt confirmation or concurrence on the Senate side to have something in the measure that would actually say that this would need to be addressed through some type of judicial proceeding, and that we, the legislature, has the duty to enact that part and make rules that would do that. And when I say rules, that would be statutes.
Go ahead. Chair members of the committee, this is, as you know, is a constitutional provision that we're amending the Constitution. And what this Section 10, at least the way I'm looking at it, does, it takes out of the Constitution the requirement that you have to have a criminal conviction before you have civil forfeiture of abused, neglected, or abandoned animals, which would say to me there'd have to be some kind of determination by court of whether the animals were abused, neglected, or abandoned. If they're not, you've got to have a criminal conviction. Now, if it's not in the Constitution, it doesn't mean that you still don't need a conviction. You have to go look at statute. And last session, we passed the omnibus bill, House Bill 3457B, which does address this issue. And I'm reading from Section 28, Subsection 5. Section 1 to 18 of this 2005 Act do not apply to forfeitures of animals subject to violations of 167.315, 167.333, 167.340. Those are all the abuse statutes, abuse, neglect, abandonment. Any such animal is subject to forfeitures as provided in subsections 1 to 3 of this section, which reads, in addition to and not lieu of any other sentence it may impose, a court may require a defendant convicted of those offenses I just listed to forfeit any rights of the defendant in the animal subject to the violation and to repay the reasonable costs incurred by any person or agency prior to judgment in caring for each animal subject to this violation. Subsection 2. When the court orders the defendant's rights in the animal to be forfeited, the court may further order that those rights be given over to an appropriate person or agency demonstrating willingness to accept and care for the animal or to the county or appropriate animal care agency for further disposition in accordance with accepted practices of humane treatment of animals. This subsection does not limit the right of the person or agency to whom rights are granted to resell or otherwise make disposition of the animal. A transfer of those rights under subsection constitutes a transfer of ownership. 3. In addition to and not lieu of any other sentence he may impose, a court may order the owner or the person having custody of the animal to repay the reasonable costs incurred by any person or agency in providing minimum care to the animals. I understand that there may be some questions concerning what reasonable costs are in some factual situations.
Would be asking too much for you to contact the ag cattle people and see if they can get some wording regarding that. And the other concern I have is if we were to have the Humane Society people with the authority to enforce any of this under forfeiture, if they were to get police powers, that we explain that it should not apply to livestock in a commercial operation, something of that nature, because there are already, as you've heard, laws governing that, and I didn't want those people getting involved in that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krueger, the only hesitation I have on that last part is that they already are, I want to call them humane officers, I'm not sure what the correct title is, that are in fact working with district attorneys and law enforcement agencies throughout the state when they're called in to help in these very large cases or cases that the local departments are not able to handle because of resource issues or whatever it may be. And I'm not sure exactly how we would structure or tailor some type of provision in the law that says that you can do certain things, but then you can't do other things that would be necessary to actually protect the welfare on those animals, and whether they're livestock or not, if they are abused, abandoned, or neglected, it seems that we would want to have them receive the same quote-unquote humane treatment as any other animal that's not classified as livestock.
I just have some concern with that category of people doing enforcement work. And I would appreciate if you could somehow get together with the ag people, cattlemen, sheep, and try to get some comfort around what this means so they are comfortable with it, and then we can support the bill.
Yeah, I'm more than willing to do that. Let me just close with this. I'll be free to, I'm here to answer any other questions. I mean, this is basically was an agreement that was reached between the various entities as to how funds can or can't be used under Measure 3. And if the bill doesn't, if this doesn't go through and is referred to the voters for passage, that part of the bill basically is going to revert to Measure 3. And Measure 3 says law enforcement does not get access to these funds. So I will be more than glad to try to meet with those individuals and try to walk them through what where it's at and see what, if anything else, they think is necessary. I think that this committee, I know this committee can strengthen what's in the resolution already to ensure that we pass or we address this issue. But as counsel has said, when you really look at how it's worded, except for forfeiture of animals, it says this section does not apply for the animals in those three categories, abused, neglected, and abandoned. And there is going to have to be, as I put on the record, on the Senate side, some determination by the court that has occurred. And I believe that the court would also be looking at, and that maybe this is the part that we want to have in there, is that as to the likelihood of success or what limitations should be placed on, let's say, transferring property right interest in those animals.
Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, before the bill went to the Senate Judiciary Committee, there was a work group meeting, and some of us have been working in this area for almost 20 years now. And it was law enforcement, Department of Justice, Senator Prezansky, and others. And one of the things that was agreed upon is that there is going to be a need as a result of the Supreme Court holding this measure constitutional and of this proposal to redraft both the civil and criminal forfeiture laws in Oregon, probably at least one more time. I think there will be a commitment towards a work group to do that, possibly for the February session. And that could be an issue that would be taken up in that process. One thing with the Constitution, it's very difficult to get into minute detail on some of these things because of the lack of flexibility. I mean, you'd have to go back to the, if you don't get it right, you have to go back to voters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My concern about this and the amendment is that it seems that the whole intent of the property in the forfeiture laws is cash and valuables and things that aren't alive. And the difference is, of course, that if you have to wait for a conviction and you have something that's alive, it's a completely different situation. And I wonder if maybe there's some way to define property as something that's not living, and then you just take the whole animal issue out of it, or just something like that, so we can address the issue of animals are a very different situation. So I don't know if that something like that would address Representative Krieger's concern.
Well, people are reflecting on that. I want to go to a more general question. Senator Prezansky, there was a bill that was passed that apparently didn't take effect because the Measure 33 case, the challenge to Measure 3 requiring asserting that it required separate votes, did not prevail at the Supreme Court. So I'm assuming the effect of the bill we passed last session in 05 is it didn't take effect because it was dependent upon the case going the other way.
Yep.
Is that right? So how does this referral here substantively, in its broader terms, you know, the animal issues are set aside, broadly, is it the basically the compromise that was struck in that legislation in 2005?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the agreement between the people that were working is that this would be something that would be referred to the voters. I mean, some of you know, not all of you know, that I was one of the advisors when that measure was being drafted. And all I can tell you is that some of us did not get what we necessarily wanted in all parts. And this was one I felt that once you got a conviction, then I thought that at that point the use of those funds could be more liberally used than what was, let's say, finally agreed upon within that work group. And so I've always had taken the position that you don't want to see dollar for dollar of whatever's taken in is going back out to law enforcement, but at the same time, once you have a conviction and someone's been found guilty of violating the law, it does seem like a portion of that money could, in fact, be directed toward continued efforts in this area of intervention. And that is basically what SJR 18 would allow, is for the voters to decide whether or not they think that is appropriate or not, because under ballot measure 3, it has already been determined that that is not allowed.
Now, as I recall, there were, in that bill from last session, there were some allocations of how the proceeds would be used, and I haven't spotted those in here, and maybe that's too detailed for the Constitution. Is that the wasn't there a certain proportion that could be spent on law enforcement efforts?
But that relief nurseries and drug court or alcohol. There was several different places.
That's what I recall. It was kind of a hierarchy or allocation that was done.
That's right.
And that's probably not in this referral because it would be too specific to be putting in the Constitution.
That's correct.
Okay. So in effect, what would happen then is there probably would need to be, assuming the voters approve this, then need to be statutory action to implement that allocation, or would that allocation, now that this is passed, would the bill that we passed back in 05 be in effect?
I would look at counsel. I would assume that it's on the books and it hasn't been taken off the books, but I would caution us that, no matter what, we need to look at it again.
Chairman, I'd suggest we bring Diane Vidlins up. I think there was two statutes last time.
Ms. Vidlins,
this one's in effect.
Excellent.
And Ms. Meyer, you could join.
They're sitting back there letting me sweat.
Steer us in the right direction here.
They're smiling a lot.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Dinah Vidlins. I'm a deputy district attorney in Crook County, Oregon. And basically, to answer your question, 3457, which was passed last legislative session, is currently unconstitutional based on the decision in Lint versus Kitzhaber. So if this SJR 18 passes, then that would make those provisions constitutional, and we would have a form of civil forfeiture. I think what Mr. Taylor was talking about is that there are things that we need to tweak that shouldn't be in the Constitution but could be part of the statutory scheme that we'd like to do in a work group and then present for the interim session in February.
So you're suggesting that this SJR 18 shouldn't be removed to send out to the voters this session. We should be reworking this further, or is it statutory implementation?
Move it immediately, and then work on the
statutory implementation of it.
Right. We don't want in the Constitution that 40% goes to law enforcement and 10% to relief nurseries, because as Rob Bovette says, meth labs are down so far that DEQ might not need money anymore, and to do that as a constitutional amendment each time would be very difficult.
Right. But in answer to the question that I posed earlier, the Supreme Court case caused the statute that we passed in 05 to be unconstitutional. As soon as if we don't pass a statutory change to alter it, though, does would the passage by the voters of this resolution cause our bill from 05 to take effect?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I believe so.
Okay, as long as it's still on the books.
Right. It's on the that's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
And if I could just quickly say one thing about the animal issue, because I did testify about the great bunny caper last time, and it was just before Easter, which I thought was significant. one thing I wanted to say is that ORS 167-347 provides a complete due process procedure for animals that have been seized. It is prior to conviction, but in the Great Bunny Caper case, I believe the defendant there had a 5-day civil hearing represented by counsel on each side. It was county counsel from Washington County, and then she had counsel in order to prove that those animals were abused, neglected, and should be forfeited. She could have avoided the whole proceeding by simply posting a bond. The issue is who pays for and how do these animals get taken care of? And I know in Central and Eastern Oregon, I would never seize a horse or a cow or anything else without a veterinary certificate that says this animal is abused or neglected. And so I know that's, you know, putting faith in the discretion of the district attorney's office, but these cases are carefully looked at, and we don't ever just seize animals because I might want a new pet.
Well, I mean, the reality, they are elected officials, and they would be accountable to the voters.
Did you have anything else to offer as your comments, Ms. Vittelins, or is that...
Just that the Oregon District Attorney's Association, the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association, Oregon State Police and Law Enforcement are behind this bill, and we'd ask that you move it.
Very good.
Question? So do you oppose the amendment?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions for Ms. Vittelins, just to stay there in case there are further come up. And Ms. Meyer?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director of the ACLU of Oregon. Actually, I'm here today on behalf of David Fidanke, our Executive Director, who has served on the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisor Committee since 1989 when this legislature enacted that. So he's one of those 20-year persons, and I am certainly not. But I just want to cover a few pieces of information around where we are today. As you may know, ACLU of Oregon was a member of the coalition that drafted Measure 3 and helped secure its passage in the 2000 election. And it was important for a number of reforms to civil forfeiture. It prohibited most forfeitures based on alleged criminal activity unless the owner of the property is convicted of a crime, and it prohibited forfeiture proceeds from being used by law enforcement agencies. The purpose of those changes was designed to ensure that the assets being taken were actually related to criminal activity and to eliminate what we perceived as a conflict of interest, because under the old system, most of the proceeds went back to the agencies that decided what property to seize and keep. And then finally, Measure 3 required that the proceeds be used for drug treatment programs. The laws to implement Measure 3 were originally adopted in 2001, but they had a 4-year sunset, so that was expiring towards the end of 2005. And I think many hoped that the legal challenge to Measure 3 would be determined by then, but it wasn't. So as the old law expired, with Senator Prezonsky and others, OCDLA and other folks, we worked to come up with what's been House Bill 3457, a compromise. We worked again this session to help implement last session's compromise and this version of Senate Joint Resolution 18 before you today. ACLU neither supports nor opposes Senate Joint Resolution 18 in its current form, but I want to give you a little bit of context. And I believe also on behalf of OCDLA and ACLU, we do not support the Dash 4 amendments and would urge you to move forward with the bill as is. Thank you.
Any questions from Ms. Meyer? Representative Wisner.
Thank you. For the both the ladies, I'm sorry. According to counsel, Senator Wisner spent a lot of time. Why are you opposing the Dash 4?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, we're opposing the Dash 4 amendments because I think the ballot measure 3 was never intended to affect animals. I think, as Representative Bonamici said, it was houses, cars, cash, things like that. And so if I, for instance, decide to prosecute an animal abuse case, then we're required to keep that animal and care for that animal through the entire criminal process. When there is a process in ORS 167347, that we can do that ahead of time. By removing animals from the Constitution, then we can use that the statute that's in effect and forfeit animals that are abused, neglected, or abandoned prior to the criminal case being resolved.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, yes, we don't believe that Measure 3 originally intended or was focused on animals. So what this does is remove that particular heightened requirement that we helped put forward in Measure 3. Without it, it was an earlier different system. So what we're saying is really the animals never belong there, and you have a statutory process that has due process protections in it, but you don't need these heightened conflict of interest, money going back to the drug enforcement, law enforcement folks, and the other thesis to which the voters enacted Measure 3. So hopefully that helps.
Councilor Taylor. Chairman of the Committee, Ms. Hidlin, my assumption in reading this, for example, if you went to forfeit a horse, not because the horse was abused, neglected, or abandoned, but because you thought it was the proceeds of illegal drug activity, my assumption is that you would have to have a criminal conviction before you could do that.
Chair McPherson, Mr. Taylor, absolutely. If I wanted to, if I thought it was a racehorse that was all drug proceeds, I would definitely have to get a conviction and follow the SDR 18 and ORS 475A requirements.
So one of the key questions, whether it's in or out of the Constitution, is whether the animal's been abused, neglected, or abandoned. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Right.
And Mr. Chair, might I add that that makes sense, because if you have an animal that's not being abused, neglected, or abandoned, it doesn't hurt to wait until there's a conviction. Mm-hmm. But if you have the abuse or neglect or abandonment, and you wait for a conviction, the animal's going to be dead by the time you get the conviction. So it just makes sense to me to have that one.
Or I had just have that. Or Chair, or you're going to have a whole lot more bunnies by the time.
Any further questions for any member of the panel here? Hearing none, then, it's my intention with the committee to not take this to work session today so we can have an opportunity to reflect a little further on the animal issues here, but I think this is a resolution that needs to move forward so we can get clarity in this area. So what I'm going to do is close the public hearing on SJR 18 and roll over a work session to tomorrow, so an opportunity for sort of offline discussion to see if there's anything further that needs to be done to it or whether it can move in its current form. Then I will, so we're not going to work session on SJR 18. The only item of business remaining on our agenda is to request a suspension of the rules to permit Representative Wisnett to vote on Senate Bills 296, 464, 1017, and 351, and Representative Bonamici to vote on Senate Bill 351. Is there any objection to suspension of the rules permitting those votes to be cast? Hearing none, then so ordered. Representative Wisnett, how do you vote on each of these bills?
Yes.
Okay. For the record,
296, Senate Bill 464A, Senate Bill 1017A, Senate Bill 351A.
Representative Wisnett votes aye on each of those four bills. Representative Bonamici, how do you vote on Senate Bill 351A?
Aye.
She votes aye. That concludes the business of our meeting. We are adjourned.
Was I the only aye, or is that all I need?